This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 23rd of March 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Today we're asking, how do you write about fashion? It's a thing, isn't it? It's big business, but it doesn't have to wear a suit. It's everywhere to the point it's tough to define, and there's more of it, especially in broadsheet newspapers, than ever before. About 1% of it is concerned with hemlines. Much more and more eloquently still, does it tell us about confidence, cash, the moment, profit and loss, how we think we're seen. We're going to speak to Charlie Porter, who writes about men's fashion, often for the Financial Times.
I realise that if I write a piece, I have to be able to say the best thing to do is to buy nothing. And that's my absolute guiding rule. And if I'm ever asked to write a piece where I can't say that, then I won't do it.
And we're going to speak to Vanessa Friedman, who mostly writes about women's fashion, and she is the fashion director of the New York Times, and will stay in New York City to talk to Nick Worcester about how to become a one-man brand as a commentator on all things fashion. It's good, isn't it? We didn't used to do stuff like this. That's all to come here on Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. My first guest today is Charlie Porter, a fashion writer who's lightened the pages of most publications that care for fashion writing. You might have seen him rocking up in the pages of the Financial Times. Now, why does the Financial Times have people that write about fashion? Because it's important and it's big biz. So, Charlie Porter, how do you write about fashion?
There's all these people who you can watch how they use words to describe a show, quite often in a quite fearless way, in a way that the brands wouldn't want them to.
Some people think there's a kind of cozy relationship, the advertising editorial thing. They might think about it with our magazine, they might think it with all sorts of, with newspapers and magazines. Presumably it's the job of a good fashion writer to make that delineation pretty clear, because the editorial that some fashion shoots look like advertising, and it's that thing.
Yeah.
So a fashion writer, and a good one, has to be pretty bold and set out his
there's different levels, because there's good fashion writing on complicit magazines. Magazines are complicit, like most monthly magazines are complicit in some way. They would not carry a negative feature about an advertiser, that's clear, and I think most editors would actually be honest about that. But there can be good writing about a complicit subject. Then there's criticism, which doesn't have any favour, or doesn't have any kind of influence from advertising. But it does still take bravery, because it's not so much bravery, but also you have to really know what it is you're saying, because the worst thing to do is to criticise flippantly and then not be able to justify it. I mean, a thing that I've learned is that I always have to be able to say what I write to someone's face, whether it be the designer or the people behind the brand. There has to be an absolute honesty about what I'm writing, so that I wouldn't be kind of embarrassed or ashamed to actually then say it to your face. So it means that you take out kind of bitchiness or kind of flippancy or like, oh, you know, or kind of playground stuff. And it's actually like, right, okay, this isn't very good, and this what is why it's not very good. That is the way I take it anyway.
This is a question we can ask of any writer, whether talking about music, movies or fashion. Presumably you prefer writing about the things you like.
No, not at all. But it's interesting you say that about music and movies, because actually it's so completely different. And actually, because I started out 3 million years ago writing about music or doing arts journalism, because it was the easiest thing to do when you're a young lad working on a paper. And I didn't enjoy it. And I always thought I would do, because that's kind of what I'd grown up thinking. And I realised it's because I like the music I like. I don't care what anyone else likes. So I don't have any desire to either convince them or tell them otherwise.
You know, you're a straight critic, though, in terms of that.
I found the criticism process very uninteresting. And also the process of being kind of after the thing is made. I found arts criticism quite boring to write about. And there's also a thing in arts criticism which you don't have in fashion criticism. So if, like, say, this week I was a music critic and I'd review the Kendrick Lamar album, and there was a readership of, like, I don't know, 1 million, then maybe like 200,000 of those people would listen to that album or buy that. You know, there's a direct relationship with people's lives. If I review the Prada show or whatever, and there's I work for a publication with a readership of 1 million, there might be like one person somewhere who buys one piece in the show that I may vaguely mention. there's no direct link with the readership. So you're doing something very different with writing. It's almost writing as entertainment as much as information. In the same way that I love reading restaurant reviews and I love reading Pete Wells in the New York Times, and I'll never go to those restaurants, but I love the entertainment and the kind of tension that he makes in the pieces.
I wonder there what your responsibility kind of is as a writer and as a critic. Your words will be read maybe first and foremost by other journalists, by other people that were sitting in the front row, and they will definitely be read presumably by the marketing teams and probably the creative teams at Prada and wherever else.
Yeah.
Does that blunt your quill ever?
No, not at all. No.
Good. No, but it's an interesting...
No, it doesn't.
It's an interesting thing. When you have that, you have a big... You've got a big powerhouse. If you're slinging arrows, they have to be well-aimed, presumably, right?
Yeah, but the thing is that it's just true. I mean, and it's also stuff that quite often other people can't say. Like, I always talk to buyers. We see the shows at the same time as buyers from the stores, and they're buying the stuff which then appears 6 months later. And I'm always interested to know what they think, to know what they really think of brands, because quite often you'll get... reviewers or journalists go, oh, I love it, whatever. And then the buyers be like, oh my God, did you see that? it's impossible for them to buy, and they know that no one's going to wear it. And I find the buying opinion really informs what I then write, because it then has a link to actually what men themselves buy. But quite often buyers can't actually say this stuff to brands either, because they're in complicit deals as well. I mean, most of the brands take the criticism as well, or take the word and actually say privately, we're happy you wrote that, or like, we're not necessarily happy, but they can see why I wrote it. I've very rarely had real problems. In my work for the FT, I've realised that when it's a show that I don't like, rather than be like, God, it was awful, I try and think, okay, what is it this brand could do to try and do better work, and what is it here that isn't right? And that I find interesting, and then I find it interesting to write about. Quite often, actually, it's enjoyable just because the show's so ridiculous that something funny happens, and then it's just a funny story. But the day passes with different things happening. So.
How practical is writing about fashion? Take your work at the FT in the weekend section, the life and arts section. Is that presumably writing about menswear? It's ready to wear. Tend to be writing about craft and cut rather than reinventing the wheel?
I mean, that's always at the base of everything in the end, but is this a really good pair of trousers?
Yeah, you have to know how they've been made.
It's not me, no, it's not, I don't have to know, but I can see that they're not very good trousers, but just for the way they sit in the line.
Okay.
It's to do with the cut and the form. In the end, that's often when a designer isn't doing good work, it's because they haven't got the basics of fit, or just their own signature coming out through fit. The best designers have, you can tell straight away when it's their jacket just from the cut. That's what makes something good. I think the thing about menswear, the exciting thing about menswear, is that it's this funny world where there's so much kind of change and newness, but then there's also stability and the same. Like, you know, you're wearing a crew neck sweater and it's lovely. And I've got many the same, you know, it's got a stupid pattern on it, you know, but there's these different kind of currents going through it. And so there's all this radical stuff happening, which I find fascinating. And then also you've got people doing super, super good work in stuff, which is just a new version and a kind of more contemporary version of something that's already been there. But also the thing about fashion as well and fashion writing is that it's all to do with sociological change. So it's the way that men's lives have changed. So that, like, the reason the men don't have to wear suit and tie is because they're no longer in an office, or they're working on their laptops from home, or they're traveling the whole time and on their bike or whatever. Like, there's all this other stuff which goes on with men and life, which kind of then informs ideas about fashion.
I love your writing in the FT, and it tells me about a subject I don't know about, and it's like reading restaurant reviews for restaurants you may not visit in New York.
Yeah.
It's liking going on a journey. It's liking feeling that you might be able to feel the fabrics, see the colours, and bring it alive. That's a great skill. Is that part of your oeuvre? Is that part of your thing, purposefully to be knowledgeable but accessible, to wear your learning lightly? Is a very charming thing to do as a writer, isn't it?
Yeah. I want it to be interesting for me.
To you, your own reader.
Yeah, basically. You know, I wrote a piece in the FT last weekend about rope and rope in fashion. And, you know, I don't normally write that sort of piece because it's a trend piece, but then it's like, oh, I went to Arthur Beale, the rope shop in Covent Garden, and
that sells all sorts of wonderful stuff, like sextants and things as well, isn't it?
The most amazing store. Yeah. And actually, I'd never, because the owners used to be really, really rude, but they've got new owners and they're really, really lovely. And it was just the loveliest hour learning all about rope, and it was such a pleasure to find out those things and then have this forum to kind of tell that story. It's a pleasure for me.
That was writer Charlie Porter. We'll have a little bit more from him at the end of the show. Now we turn to Vanessa Friedman, director of fashion and chief fashion critic for the New York Times, to talk about different styles of writing. Friedman recently wrote a piece about President Obama's watch, and I began by asking her how she chooses to cover a story like that.
Generally, I try to look at what's going on in the world around me and around readers that would allow them a way into a topic that is maybe a fashion topic, but has a relevance beyond the fashion world. You know, I think we can get very insular. And so the more connections you can draw between products, clothing, accessories, what have you, you know, and how that impacts, you know, readers' lives who may not be in the fashion world or may not think about fashion very much, I think the more useful stories are to them.
And of course, I mean, there's also the flip side of this in the first marriage, I suppose, is also the fact that Michelle Obama's fashion has been much discussed and all the rest of it. President Obama's probably less so, but his watch presumably is that thing, is that signifier that breaks through all sorts of people. Everybody thinks that they know what that watch might mean. So it's quite fun to take that line for a walk, presumably in print.
Well, I also think, you know, if you look at what happened with his tan suit last August, which practically broke the internet before Kim Kardashian, her naked body got there, you know, I think there is real interest in what any public figure wears. There just happens to be more material generally when it comes to women, largely because they change their clothes more or in more obvious ways. So I think whenever a male leader, be it a business leader or a political leader, wears something that is visibly different, you know, it creates a kind of ripple effect.
Your piece on Obama's watch, it seemed like the sort of new form of fashion writing, that it's reactive to something that people will probably be familiar with, that picture might well be doing the rounds on blogs, but you can obviously have a more definitive stance on it, you know, coming as you do from the New York Times and maybe making it a bit more of a cultural signifier. Is that fair to say that this style of fashion reporting is that more reactive, tied into news, tied into personality?
Well, I think there are different kinds of fashion reporting, and this is one of them, you know, which has to do with kind of analysis of the world around you. The other one is, you know, straightforward reporting about a news story, be it a business story or a fashion story or a personality story, you know, and then there's criticism. So there are different sides of the discipline, I guess, if you want to call it that.
You mentioned the business of fashion. This is presumably, it's a lot of the editorial that is written, certainly in the New York Times, the Financial Times, the broadsheet end of things is often about the business of fashion rather than straight critique of a new collection of a runway show and all the rest of it. I wonder which one you kind of come to first and how you decide which one to run in that day's paper. Presumably, obviously, there's the idea of newsworthiness. I just sometimes wonder whether you feel that talking about the business as much as critiquing the collections lets a bit of daylight in upon magic of the fashion, you know, of fashion's magic, I suppose.
No, I mean, I think, you know, effectively it is looking at an evolution in the fashion world that has occurred over the last two decades, you know, where the corporate side and the creative side of the business have grown ever closer together, you know, driven largely by its growth as an industry and as a publicly listed industry. And whereas for a long time, you know, what happened in small family businesses that were private was not particularly well-known or impactful versus what was public, which was the clothes on the runway. Now the two are, you know, effectively two sides of the same whole. And I don't think you can really report about one without knowing about the other or reporting on the other. So I think it's actually a reflection of what has happened in the industry.
Yeah, it's interesting you should say that, that you can't really, you can't write about one without knowing about the other. There's maybe an analogy with the art world that maybe people think that in more straitened times, certainly sort of at art fairs, people take a lot of things that you can hang over your fireplace. They take kind of safe oil paintings and things, perhaps. Whereas in more flush times, people can take kind of risks. Do you see those correlations quite obviously in fashion, whether a designer or a house is having to sort of play its cards close to its chest economically and can come out with a little bit more of a conservative collection because of that? I wonder whether those runes are easy to read in fashion as maybe they are in the other markets.
I'm not sure it has, you know, a direct correlation to the economy at large. I think it definitely has. It correlates to the rise of public companies and the need to report quarterly results, you know, which has driven brands toward a real focus on sales growth every couple months, and that clearly creates a situation where you want to dip into something that may be perhaps less challenging, more accessible, more, you know, easier to move. And I think we see that. We see that with the rise of contemporary. We see it with the infiltration of contemporary price points, designers, designs into the high end. So I think it's probably more a function of that, which is exacerbated by, you know, recessionary conditions.
And I just wonder if you have a reader in your mind, whether that's something that maybe that is more the habit of the younger fashion journalist or the less experienced one, but that you don't need to think of a reader, that your tone of voice is kind of automatic.
I mean, I think of one in terms of, you know, when I'm thinking about what would interest them in terms of stories, you know, particularly that day or what their concerns are, or what their life is like, and how fashion fits into that. But it's a very, very broad tent definition, because clearly the Times has very broad tent readers.
Yeah, sure. And I wonder that. I mean, I wonder whether the success, you know, one of the successes of a really good fashion story is that it could end up on the business pages, all the culture pages, all the design pages, you know, that all these imposters are just the same. If a story is a fascinating one, it can be almost in any discipline other than foreign affairs and sit equally in any page in that newspaper. Do you know what I mean? Is that a discussion that's had at editorial conference?
Well, I mean, I think the thing about fashion is that increasingly it really has become a part of every single aspect of life, you know, whether it is sports or politics or business or culture. And, you know, so you do see it in every area of the paper and you do see it covered very broadly. And, you know, and certainly for readers, that's true, too, you know, that they have become very aware of fashion as part of the pop culture conversation, you know, or the feminist conversation. And therefore, you know, it's properly treated that way.
That was Vanessa Friedman, director of fashion and chief fashion critic for The New York Times. After the break, we'll ask Nick Worcester why some people are opting for photojournalism over the written word. Stay tuned.
The Monocle Daily sets the agenda in Asia and considers what's been dominating the day in Europe and North America.
The programme is often co-hosted out of our Toronto and New York bureau and features regular interviews with special guests both there and across the Americas, as well as experts and analysts at our studios in London.
Monocle 24's regular weekly guide to the perfect Friday night in includes some of our favourite cities around the world and features the insights of the people who know those places best, our unrivalled network of correspondents.
Join me, Emma Nelson.
And me, Andrew Muller.
Your regular hosts for the Monocle Daily every weekday at 6 a.m. in Tokyo, 2200 hours in London.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Band, and today we're asking, how do you write about fashion? We're going to sidestep now into photography. In an increasingly noisy online environment, fashionistas around the globe are competing to become internet icons. For consumers who want a quick hit of fashion, photo blogs are an easy way to find out who's wearing what and where. And since the rise of websites like the Sartorialist, it seems everyone wants a snapshot of the action, whether they're behind the camera or in front of it.
Nick Worcester has spent decades in the retail world working with top department stores like Bergdorf Goodman. But since leaving Bergdorf 4 years ago, he's gone on to collaborate with brands such as Lardini in Italy. His daily fashion is documented by street photographers around the globe, and his stamp of approval packs a punch. Monocle's Megan Billings met Worcester at his West Village home in New York to chat about why some choose to turn to him for fashion tips and how you communicate through clothes.
I was at a dinner a year ago, and an investment banker had an interesting take on me or people like me. He had no idea who I was, which was totally refreshing. And we were talking about, you know, why would I have a following or a readership or a fan base, let's say, that is the size of a magazine, or in some cases, maybe even bigger, which how insane is that? Because like you said, I'm not a journalist. And he said that his take on it is that it's because institutions are failing. Wall Street, you know, Washington. And I think that the role that media and retailers played 20 or 30 years ago has shifted. And so it's not that I'm replacing, but I think people, you know, used to maybe go to their local, you know, men's shop, and the, you know, the sort of the salesman of the father would tell the son how to get dressed for an interview or what he needed to get married or these kinds of things. And today, the internet, and I think individuals are sort of filling that void sort of left by the lack of specialty stores and maybe the quality of the people in them today. So it's an interesting thing. And again, it's a responsibility that I guess I hope that I could sort of rise to the occasion where, yeah, I do have people who are interested. So it's my responsibility to do a good job in the same way that a journalist should do the same. And I hope, and again, I don't think I'm a journalist, but I do think that I am able to communicate something. If
you
feel like grooving,
if you feel like you kind of have this retail background, and now you're in this space where people really look to you to almost say yes or no to a brand. In a way, you have so many people looking at what you're wearing and photographing you. And when we're thinking about communicating fashion, when you get dressed in the morning, does that run through your mind that thousands of people might be seeing what you have on?
It doesn't. I mean, I get dressed for myself, but I am acutely aware of the fact that when I go to work and it happens to be during a fashion week, that yes, anything I'm wearing is probably going to be noticed. And therefore, it's not that I have a responsibility, but I try to be aware of what either choices I'm making, or, you know, if there's a friend who's something I want to wear, or just, you know, I do recognize that there's power in what I'm doing, at least today. And so in that regard, I feel somewhat responsible, but it's really, I only get dressed for myself.
I'm also just thinking about the fact that you said, you know, you owe a lot of this to the internet, and there are so many fashion blogs and street style photographers, and it's really hard to sift through what's real and what's just someone wishing they could have a say in the fashion world. And, you know, you have a certain authenticity in the way that you style yourself because it is just for yourself. But how do you determine what's good and what's bad? And how do you know when someone's succeeding or not succeeding?
Well, I don't really think that I make the, you know, I'm not a critic. So believe me, I have opinions, but I choose not to share them because it's not my place. I would probably be ridiculed if I did something like that. So I have them, I keep them to myself, or I share them with my close friends. But I do think that in a way, I act as a filter. And maybe that's what me and many other people get the opportunity to do. Because you're right, everybody has a megaphone today. And so there is a lot of noise. And some of it's good, some of it isn't. I'm sure that journalists have an opinion about bloggers. I know that retailers have an opinion about, you know, how commerce has changed. And I'm not here to argue whether that's right or wrong, good or bad. All I am is happy that I have a platform to be able to do that thing that I've always done, which is, you know, I just wear what I'm interested in. So if people are looking for an endorsement, all they have to do is look at what it is. And if I'm not wearing it, it probably means I'm not endorsing it. And I'm always amazed by people who sort of send me things or try to get me to you know, publish something. And I think, first of all, I'm flattered that they would ask me to do that. But at the end of the day, I can't possibly do it all. But I'm also so amazed because it's like, when have you ever seen me wear something like that? And yet they continue to do it. So it's funny. And again, all I'm doing is me. And so if it's not of interest to someone, and believe me, there's plenty of haters who have made fun of or who've said, you know, you look ridiculous. And you're probably right. But by the same token, I'm not trying to tell people this is what they should do. I'm just doing what I choose to do. And the fact that some people are following it is, I'm happy to go along with it. I'm not trying to change the world. I'm not, you know, curing cancer. I'm just getting dressed.
That was Nick Worcester speaking to Monocle's Megan Billings. And just before we go, we're going to hear from Charlie Porter again, who has a few practical tips for how to write or how not to write about fashion.
Fashion loves to think it's an industry that's existed for like thousands and thousands of years and loves the word legendary and loves the word iconic and loves the word timeless. And most of these brands have been around for like 20 years or 30 years, 40 years maybe, 100 years, but completely different guys. That iconic products have sold well for like 20, 30 years. The kind of belief in kind of permanence in fashion is a complete, you know, obviously just not true. I mean, you just don't say it. Like, you know, but, and also the thing of must have as well, that sort must. Of language of presuming that the reader must have something.
That's kind of the cover line on
most things.
A magazine in which you get a free pair of flip-flops in the summer.
Must have. But I mean, the things I realised about 5 or 6, 7 years ago when I was trying to work out what it is that I did, I realised that if I write a piece, I have to be able to say the best thing to do is to buy nothing. And that's my absolute guiding rule. And if I'm ever asked to write a piece where I can't say that, then I won't do it. Like if it's assuming that I'm just going to say, oh, buy this Valentino, or buy this thing, or buy this whatever, and I can't say, no, really, don't don't buy that, then that's my rule.
I wonder, when we get the fashion press here in the office, there tends to be consensus that something is a great show. The Prada show is wonderful. This Taylor has put on a wonderful show. And maybe it is the collected media. We like to group things together to sort of tell a story and have a narrative about things. Do you think there's a sort of consensus for these things? Everyone thinks this is wonderful, like everyone thinks that something is a wonderful film.
Yeah, sometimes, but then often really not. I mean, I think there are some designers and brands where the experience you get there is extraordinary. So there is a consensus because it's amazing. Often with fashion, it's an absolute honour to be in that room having had that stuff produced for you. But then also there can be complete utter disagreement. And we all obviously love it when we all disagree as well. And like the battle over Saint Laurent has been the big battle of the last few years. And I've been one of the few pro Saint Laurent, certainly in menswear. And it's been fascinating to watch because it's been this kind of absolute outrage at everything and what they've done, and it's so clear that the brand wanted journalists to be outraged, and they fell for it, like they really fell for it, and they continue to fall for it, and the brand has since gone on to be the most extraordinary success without journalists, which I think is the biggest lesson of all, that like we really are completely irrelevant to the whole thing. You know, we're there as a bit of entertainment, but to believe we're important is it's a mistake.
That was Charlie Porter answering our question this week. How do you write about fashion? He says it's important to report rather than sell. You need to be wise to the tricks of the designers, and not everything is iconic, timeless, or indeed a must-have. The war against cliché continues. We're glad to report. How do you write about fashion? You make it your business, even if you love it. You've been listening to Culture on Monocle 24, and my producer was Holly Fisher, who is indeed iconic, timeless, and indeed a must-have. The show was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Megan Billings. And join us at the same time next week. But for the time being, I'm Robert Pound. Thanks for tuning in.